From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump made his first address to the United Nations this morning. He said parts of the world were, quote, going to hell, and he singled out Iran and Venezuela, as well as North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and his nuclear missile tests.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
Joining us now from New York is Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent. Michelle, we'll talk about what he said about North Korea, but overall, what struck you about the speech and how it was received in the chamber?
Well, he was quite combative, Jeremy, using language that we don't usually see in that kind of a setting. He was defending his America First agenda, talking about the importance of sovereignty, and also challenging the world body to live up to its expectations to resolve problems. You know, some of these kind of nationalist themes may have gotten him a lot of applause at a political rally, but here the response was rather muted. When he was blasting North Korea, for instance, the cameras turned to the empty chairs at the North Korean delegation right in the front row. When he blasted Iran, we could see the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu nodding his head in agreement, but not a lot of applause on some of those big themes.
Was his language about North Korea an escalation? He used the term Rocket Man, but that's something that he had used in a tweet just the other day.
Right. But, you know, to hear it and to see it in a tweet and to hear it at a diplomatic forum like this is quite something. And, you know, it was kind of jolting to hear. But it's also possible that what he's trying to do is just jolt the UN to act, especially China and Russia. China is the biggest trading partner with North Korea, and the U.S. really wants to see China do something about it. But those countries want the U.S. to get serious about negotiating with North Korea. So, you know, while Trump is talking tough on the world stage, other countries are talking about the need for a political solution. And by the way, Trump's speech came shortly after Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke to the General Assembly, and he said fiery talk can lead to fatal misunderstandings. This is a time for statesmanship, he said. We must not sleepwalk our way into war.
Trump also talked about Iran. He called that country an economically depleted rogue state and a murderous regime. And he said this about the nuclear deal that the Obama administration negotiated with Iranian leaders.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it. Believe me.
I don't think you've heard the last of it. First of all, what does that mean? And secondly, are U.S. officials going to be meeting with Iranians this week in New York?
Well, what it means is the Trump administration doesn't like the deal because it didn't cover other sides of Iranian behavior. It didn't cover the missile program. It didn't cover human rights and terrorism and everything else. So the U.S. wants the world to get tougher on Iran about all those other things. And it also has some very specific concerns about the nuclear deal and how long it goes into effect, for instance, these so-called sunset clauses. And there's some idea that the U.S. wants to renegotiate some of this. Now, the Europeans and others are pushing back. They want the nuclear deal to stay in place. At least it keeps Iran's nuclear program in check for the time being, especially at a time when the world has to turn its attention to North Korea. The Europeans are organizing a meeting tomorrow on the sidelines of the General Assembly, and that's where we expect Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to have his first face-to-face encounter with his Iranian counterpart. The two men haven't even spoken, according to State Department officials.
Michelle, the leaders of Russia and China are not there this week in New York. But President Trump did mention Ukraine, and he mentioned the conflict in the South China Sea, where China's been claiming territory. What was his message to Russia and China?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, those countries often talk about sovereignty as a key issue. And President Trump said sovereignty is key for everybody. And he said that should also apply to places like Ukraine, where Russia has annexed Crimea and still has troops and support for rebels, Russian-led rebels in the east of Ukraine. So, you know, he's saying we got to solve problems. We have to work as individual countries,
right.
But also that includes those two countries.
That's NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman in New York at the UN. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's check in on Puerto Rico as Maria, now a Category 5 hurricane, aims squarely at the island and could hit tomorrow morning. Irma just skirted Puerto Rico, but still left swaths without power and with a lot of damage, all compounded by the U.S. territory's financial problems. It essentially declared bankruptcy in May with billions of dollars in debt. Reporter Miguel Santiago is with the public radio station Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico. He joins us by Skype from San Juan. Miguel, what's the sense there?
It feels, and I'm really sorry to say this, it feels kind of ironic. You know, most Puerto Ricans were feeling pretty relieved when Hurricane Irma, you know, didn't cause the damage that we expected. Now we have another Category 5 hurricane, Hurricane Maria, going right through Puerto Rico, which is pretty worrisome. You know, some people in Puerto Rico still don't have power after the aftermath of Hurricane Irma. So now the governor, Ricardo Rosselló, at a press conference just said the whole island is expected to not have power, you know.
Well, the whole island is expected to have Category 5 force winds. I mean, it's going to cover the entire island. Look, I'm wondering, too, if there are, you know, there were a million people without power after Irma, if people are getting the message out, you know, that Maria is coming if they don't have power. But also, we know that the infrastructure, because of Puerto Rico's bankruptcy, the infrastructure has been neglected. I mean, is it assumed that homes could blow away?
Yes. You know, unfortunately, that is expected. You know, most homes can be just completely flooded. We have some people in Puerto Rico have, you know, just very weak structure buildings. But still, you know, it's their home.
Yeah. Look, we also know that people evacuated from other islands to Puerto Rico because of Irma. Is there a place for people in Puerto Rico to go? Are there shelters?
There are. There are shelters all around the island. They have food. They have water. The structure overall for shelters are pretty good. But, you know, again, most people, they can stay at their homes because they have a good structured home. But like, then again, a high number of people are going to have to take shelters because of they're really vulnerable to floods.
You say people do have some food and water in shelters. But has rationing begun? Because we're hearing reports that rationing of water and baby formula, for instance, has begun. People also worry about medical needs, oxygen, insulin. What's happening to prepare for that?
Well, at least for hospitals, we had a problem after Irma because some places, malls or stores, had power before hospitals, which angered a lot of civilians. Right now, one of the main priorities is to have, you know, for the hospitals to have power. Mm-hmm. Food prices are expected to stay the same. You know, the tax on food is going to be eliminated throughout, I believe, until Sunday.
Yeah, there are some places that actually pass laws saying that merchants can't raise prices on things like food in advance
exactly,
of a
yeah.
storm. Right, and so you're going to eliminate the taxes there. Look, are people flying off the island?
Not that I heard of. I don't think most people have the budget to just call a flight. Most people just stay at their homes.
Look, they're talking, meteorologists are talking about the dreaded pinhole eye in Maria and compare it to an ice skater when, you know, an ice skater spins a certain amount of time, like a hurricane spins. But then at the very end, they bring their arms in and it's just this incredibly super spin. That's apparently the state that Maria is at. With this pinhole eye, very tight spin. Are people there afraid?
Well, of course. You know, Maria went from tropical storm to Category 5, I believe, in about 24 hours. You know, that's unbelievable. Yesterday, I was given the news that it was a Category 2 storm at a press conference for the governor. I leave, and then suddenly it's Category 4. And it's incredible how fast this atmospheric event is developing.
Well, now it's a 5. Miguel Santiago, again, of Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico, where are you going to be? What are you going to do?
During a hurricane, you know, since most people is out of power, most people rely on the radio for immediate information. So we're going to try at least to keep the community here in San Juan informed. So, yeah, to answer your question, I'll be staying here at the radio station while the event passes through Puerto Rico.
Well, we remember when Nisha Dupuy, who is a 19-year-old broadcaster in Anguilla, did the same thing, and it was rough. I mean, the shutters were banging, and the roof was threatened with being ripped off, and she kept broadcasting. So bravo to you for doing that.
Thank you, Rob. Yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Miguel Santiago, again with Radio Universidad de Puerto Rico, the public radio station there, awaiting Hurricane Maria. Miguel, thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, we should note that Maria already plowed through the island of Dominica. We'll watch her path tomorrow. Call back, Miguel.
There was a 3.6 earthquake in the Los Angeles area last night. It was minor enough for some people to sleep through, but it's a reminder of another potential disaster, a major earthquake in California. Given all the questions about whether Florida or Texas could have been more prepared for their recent disasters, let's look at the preparation in California for the big one. We're joined by Lucy Jones, who's a research associate at the Seismological Laboratory of Caltech. Dr. Jones, welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And there have been reports for a long time that a big quake is due in California, maybe overdue. Is there really a way to predict that?
There is no way to predict the time of when it will happen, but that it will happen is an absolute certainty. It's like, you know, you aren't going to stop the sun shining and you aren't going to stop the plates moving. And as long as the plates keep on moving, eventually the earthquakes have to happen. We just don't know when.
And we think that a major quake is overdue?
Overdue implies that we're increasing the likelihood because of how long it's been since the last one. But as far as we can tell, the timing is pretty random. What we can say is that every year in California has at least a 1% chance of a very, very large earthquake and a several percent chance of an earthquake, a small earthquake like the size of Northridge, which was the 94 earthquake.
Right, in the Los Angeles area. And right. Is there more of a fear of a quake affecting L.A. or San Francisco, or is it an equal chance?
They're reasonably close. We're both sitting on the plate boundary, and the San Andreas Fault is the fastest moving fault and therefore has earthquakes the most often. Overall, the LA area ends up with more events, partly because the plate boundary here is much more complicated. There's really three faults to worry about in the Bay Area and about 300 faults to worry about in Southern California.
Is there the possibility of an earthquake that would affect the entire state of California at the same time?
It's improbable, extremely improbable, that we would have one earthquake that was so large as to affect both areas. I mean, the magnitude of an earthquake tells you the length of the fault that moves. And we have a sort of a section between the two regions that doesn't move easily in big earthquakes. It has a lot of small ones instead. That said, one earthquake triggering another is extremely common, and it's not just very nearby and calling them aftershocks. It also happens at greater distances. So a magnitude 8 on the San Andreas in Southern California triggering a 7 on the Hayward Fault in San Francisco as essentially a distant aftershock, that's a much more probable scenario.
So one could affect the other.
Oh, yeah. We definitely see earthquake triggering over distances of hundreds of miles.
So the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco is still one of the worst disasters in American history. This is one that people look back to. It killed about 3,000 people. What would an earthquake of the same magnitude mean for San Francisco today?
Probably many dead, maybe as many or more. Because we have so many more people there now,
right?
We have building codes, but your building's as good as the building code in place when it was built. So, you know, the most modern ones include everything that we know about earthquakes at this point. But there are classes of buildings, especially some of the older concrete commercial buildings, that we know to be very vulnerable. And we expect to, if they don't get retrofitted, they will collapse in the bigger earthquakes and kill a lot of people at the time. Our cities have become more complex entities, and we are more dependent on engineered systems to sustain life. In 1906, you lost your sewer. You really could go and dig a hole in your backyard. It's not really an option anymore. And so the likely destruction of sewer pipes is a potential public health nightmare. I've actually studied it in more detail for Southern California, where we took a big San Andreas earthquake and tried to say what would happen to Los Angeles. We got an estimate of about 2,000 dead for that earthquake.
And there would be a lot of fires. I was reading that that would be one of the major problems that would lead to a lot of deaths.
Oh, absolutely. Of course, it happened in 1906, and much of the city was burnt in that event. Every time we've had a really large earthquake in a dense urban area, we've seen catastrophic fires. And, you know, in Northridge in 94 in Los Angeles, in 1989, the Loma Prieta earthquake in the Bay Area, each of those produced more than 100 fires that required all of the capacity they had to fight them. And they were able to get those fires in control because those weren't very big earthquakes. When we scale up to the San Andreas earthquake, we expect something like 20 times as many households to receive the same level of shaking. And our estimate was 1,600 fires for a Los Angeles area earthquake, comparable for Northern California. And then you don't, you know, the way a modern fire department acts now is it depends that for the very biggest events, mutual aid, other places send in aid. But when you have a really big earthquake, your cry for help is going to be met by a plea for help in return. And our mutual aid is going to have to come in from other states and take time to get there. So the analyses of what a fire could be like in our really big earthquake still looks like a potentially catastrophic event. You know, San Francisco, after the 1906 earthquake burned down the city, as they rebuilt, they built in cisterns. So they have buried water supplies, big cisterns under various parts of the city, as a completely separate water system as a backup for the worst fires. And of course, it decayed over the years, but actually, when Senator Feinstein was mayor of San Francisco, she authorized rebuilding the system, and they have that for the city of San Francisco itself. But, you know, most of the Bay Area is not the city of San Francisco. We don't have it here in Los Angeles, and it doesn't make sense to come in and say, you know, put cisterns under the city now. But the new seismic resilience measure that Mayor Garcetti of Los Angeles has undertaken includes a partnership between the fire department and the water department to try and develop an alternative firefighting system, probably tapping into our drainage channels and rivers, trying to look for any water source we can. The messaging to individuals includes make sure you have a fire extinguisher and know how to use it. And a fire that you would have called the fire department for without the earthquake, you've got to try and fight it yourself in that earthquake response mode, because if it gets out of control, there's nobody that can really fight it. And it's probably the scariest picture when we look at what's going to happen during the big earthquake.
One of the big problems in Florida following Hurricane Irma has been the loss of power around the state. What do we know about what would happen in California in a big earthquake and how difficult it would be to get power back up again?
It's maybe the second scariest thing after what we look at happens with the fire. Power companies here, of course, have gone through a few earthquakes. They know what happens, and they're trying to gear up for it. Again, the problem is the scale. When we have a San Andreas earthquake that's 20 times as long a fault as we had in Northridge or Loma Prieta, then it's the scale of doing it is very, very difficult. We worry about loss of transmission into the region because all of our big transmission lines have to cross the San Andreas Fault to get to us. Same with our outside water. You know, Southern California is famous for the water coming in. This is true in the Bay Area as well, that most of the lifeline systems come in across the fault. Now, most of the big utilities are doing a lot of work trying to mitigate it. It's requiring a different approach. And we're seeing in the last few years a recognition that, I was able to handle Northridge doesn't mean you can handle the big one. And there's a lot of planning efforts going on in both Northern and Southern California right now. So I have hope because of that. But we should expect that there will be a big enough problem somewhere in the grid when the earthquake happens that the whole grid will shut down. And then it's going to be a question of how do we get that back up and started again.
after Hurricane Harvey, a lot of people looked at Houston and said, well, because of the design of Houston, it made the problem worse because of the overdevelopment of Houston. Similarly, in Florida, people said, you know, because of all of the development, a lot more people are being affected because they're living in low-lying areas next to the coast. What do you think people will be saying after the next quake in California when they start to look at what might have been done better to avoid the catastrophe?
Well, I will point out that California is much more enamored of regulation than Texas or Florida. So there actually are a lot of codes in place that will help. One of the things that will surprise people, don't surprise me, your building's only as good as the building code in place when it was built. And our older buildings have known problems. I think there are going to be a lot of people are going, wait a minute, how come my building fell down? You know, don't we have building codes? That's one issue. The other one is that the current code is aimed at life safety. We have sort of philosophically said, if you choose to make such a weak building that it's a total financial loss during the earthquake, that's your financial choice to make. The role of government is to make sure you don't kill somebody in the process. And because of that, I think we will see a much smaller death toll than we might have otherwise seen. But we're going to have a lot of new, brand new two-code buildings that are a complete financial loss after the event. Most building owners are barely aware that that, in fact, is what the code is giving them, crawl out alive. We've been talking about it a lot in the last few years, and I think we're starting to see some energy because the increased cost of a usable building compared to just life safety is about 1% the construction cost. A lot of people think that could be worthwhile.
That's Lucy Jones, who is a research associate at the Seismological Laboratory of Caltech and the founder of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. Very interesting. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Apple's new mobile operating system, iOS 11, launches today, and its new iPhone 8 model will appear in stores later this week. But it's the iPhone 10 that's catching the most attention and skepticism. The $1,000 smartphone will have features like facial recognition. It was unveiled last week, but won't begin shipping until November. And if history is any indication, customers can expect a short supply. Here to explain is our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Dan Frommer is editor-in-chief of Recode. He joins us from New York. Hi, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we've had a week to think about this new iPhone X. What's been the reaction?
Well, most people haven't seen it yet, and it really is something you should see. It's really impressive looking. The screen is very vibrant. But it does work differently, and I think that's going to be the most interesting thing we'll see as it kind of permeates out into the world. Two big things. First of all, the home button is gone.
Right. You
may not think about it, but you use that home button dozens or hundreds of times a day. So there's definitely a new behavior you have to learn just in terms of navigating the phone. But also kind of the headline is that it recognizes you based on your face, not just your fingerprint.
Right.
So what we don't know is how well that works.
Now, analysts are predicting supply shortages, which has been the case before, and not just for Apple. So how does that happen? Because Silicon Valley prides itself on knowing all the data. Why aren't they making enough phones?
Well, there's two kind of opposing forces of supply and demand. So first of all, demand is going to be highest right when the phone launches and then right around the holidays, which this year is even closer to the launch than in usual times. And then there's the supply issue. They have to balance starting making them with how many of each component they can get, how many screens they can get, with how far in advance should they start making them so that they don't leak the Of course, everything got leaked this year,
right.
So that wouldn't have helped. But so they don't leak the design versus can they get even newer technology into it? And how well are they at making them once they start making them? And then can they make enough of them fast enough, but not too many of them that they have to shut down machines later? So it's a delicate balance. It's never perfect.
What about the fact that the iPhone 8 is going to be released later this week, but the 10 later? Do they think that the 8 will sort of dampen the enthusiasm for the 10 or that people won't buy the 8 because they want to wait for the 10?
It's interesting psychology, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm waiting for the 10. I think a lot of people will, but I also know some people who surprised me and pre-ordered the 8. So we'll see.
And that $1,000 price tag for the 10 wireless carriers have changed the way consumers pay for phones into what is essentially a loan. There aren't that many deals, but will there be deals for the iPhone 10, even though they're saying there won't?
I've been really amazed at how much attention this $1,000 price tag has gotten. Yeah. When you think about how phones have creeped up to that level for years. Here's the reality. Most people are not going out and dropping $1,000 on a phone in one payment. There are installment plans. There are yearly upgrade plans. There are leases where you don't actually own the phone. You're just paying essentially a rental fee.
Right.
And we're at the point where basically every American is going to have a different payment plan for their phone based on which carrier they use, based on their credit level, right. All these things. And then there's the cost of the service on top of it. So. Right.
So it's going to cost you a lot of money, basically, to have a phone, even if it's a payment plan. Right.
A lot of money, but an incredible value.
That's Dan Frommer, editor-in-chief at Recode. Dan, thank you.
Of course.
And now to FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program. It's been around since 1968. It's set to expire in December. It's heavily in debt, partly because not enough people buy the flood insurance, so the pot isn't big enough. Of those who do buy and get federal payouts to fix homes, a small percentage are repeatedly flooded and paid, sometimes for more than the property is worth. And that's created the image of the seaside homeowner living off taxpayer generosity and led to debate over extending the program. But yesterday, we spoke with Dean Bixler in Houston. He understands the criticism, even though he's one of those who's been repeatedly flooded and reimbursed.
If I lived along a river or lived along the coast, I would completely agree with him. Unfortunately, ours is a man-made issue because of development on steroids in the area.
You see, Dean didn't know he was in a flood area because maps are outdated, and he's now suing Houston for creating flood risks. Let's bring in Logan Strother. He's a visiting scholar in law and public affairs at Princeton. His piece in the Washington Post argues that flood insurance will help clean up after Hurricanes Irma and Harvey, and that's a problem. He joins us on Skype. Hi, Logan.
Hi, Robin.
Okay, so we'll get to that, why that is a problem. But here we just hear from Dean Bixler, who flooded several times. He's one of those people that people get annoyed at. They think that the flood insurance program should not cover people like him who repeatedly get flooded and repeatedly get bailed out. But as he points out, he thinks the fault lies with Houston, which overpaved the city and let developers build in places where they shouldn't, including his house. Is that part of this debate as well, that there are people who don't want to be in a floodplain, they just didn't know they were?
Yeah, so it's certainly true that a lot of people don't understand how much flood risk they face. In much of the country, the risk maps that the National Flood Insurance Program and FEMA use to assess the risk that properties face are out of date. In more than 50% of these maps are more than 15 years old, and another close to 10% are more than 10 years old. In some places, it's simply the case that no one knows how much flood risk properties face.
Right. And what we've been hearing post-Houston, certainly the floodplains are larger than people think. Well, how did we get here? You trace it back to the historic Mississippi River flood of 1927. We've spoken about that on this program. Insurers got out of the market because it was just too risky a bet. There was too much flooding there. Then in 1968, you have Hurricane Betsy hitting the Gulf Coast, 76 people killed, more than $1.5 billion in damage. As you write, that would be $10 billion. In modern day. What happened then?
Well, a lot of people viewed the absence of flood insurance covering this massive liability after Betsy as a market failure. They viewed the lack of private insurers in that business as evidence that the government needed to intervene and to offer flood insurance. In an important sense, though, the fact that flood insurance was prohibitively expensive, or that in many places you couldn't get it at all, was precisely the point. That market condition should have induced people not to move to or not to build in and develop these high-risk areas.
And this is what people are saying today about not extending the National Flood Insurance Program because, as you say, it oddly gives people an incentive to move to areas where they shouldn't move because they know the government will cover them with insurance or help them with disaster relief.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, but there have been attempts over time to change things. Talk about that.
After every major flooding event, there are reform efforts of one kind or another. Very often, these reforms are aimed at increasing market penetration, that is, getting more people to participate in the program so that there is more money in the program and so that the program is then better able to cover losses.
And part of this is requiring flood insurance for some mortgages.
That's right. If you have a mortgage and you're in a flood risk zone, then you are required by law to have flood insurance.
Well, after Hurricane Katrina, Congress passed some reform. It was called the Biggert Waters Act of 2012. It phased out subsidies for properties, eliminated them for these repetitive loss properties, flood after flood. They, you know, some of them, I mean, the numbers are astounding. Something like millions has been put into homes that are only worth a couple hundred thousand. It phased that out.
Yeah, that's right. The size of the disaster of Hurricane Katrina essentially made the problem too big to ignore. And that's why they were finally able to get Congress to adopt some of these policies that they've been advocating for a long time.
But then, as you write, just 14 months later, Congress passed another law, the Homeowner Flood Insurance Affordability Act of 2014, which pretty much rolled back anything that the Biggert Waters reforms did, revived the subsidies, increased deductibles, things like that. Is this too politically fraught an issue? When you see people whose homes are destroyed on the coast, is it that lawmakers just cannot say no?
It is starting to look that way, yes. It's very hard when you have a program that confers concentrated benefits like this, and the costs are very diffusely borne across all taxpayers, to generate enough interest for a meaningful reform measure, right? Because the people that would gain won't gain very much, not enough that they would even notice. But the people that stand to lose something stand to lose quite a lot, potentially.
Mm. Well, so what happens now? Many of these people are people who have been sold a home by a developer who don't have a clue that it has the problems that it has, or they've been there for years, propped up by the government since, you know, the mid-60s, rebuilding, and they can't resell because who wants to buy a home that's flooded 10 times, you know, on the shore of New Jersey, for instance, to pick one, or a Long Island after Sandy?
Sure.
What about that idea of the government, instead of funneling money into these homes, buying them at full value and taking them off the land so the land can absorb water?
That's absolutely something that many people are talking about, particularly for repetitive and severe repetitive loss properties. Government buybacks are one way that we need to be thinking about trying to address these. And in fact, FEMA does have a buyback program. It's pretty small so far, but it's maybe one prong of the way forward.
What are the others?
I think one important one, we're in the process of updating all of our flood risk maps so that hopefully very soon we'll have a much better picture of what flood risk looks like around the country.
Before we hear the next, do you think people are going to be surprised?
I think people will be surprised if they find out about it at all, which leads into my next point, which is I think we need to start talking about flood risk differently. Most people just don't appreciate what a 100-year floodplain means or a 500-year floodplain means. So it's hard for them to assess the risk that they face in those terms. A 100-year floodplain means that there's about a 1% chance that a property is flooded in any given year. That sounds like not a big risk, but if you start talking about these risks in real-life terms, I think they make more sense to people. So, for example, if you're buying a house in a 100-year floodplain and you want to take out a 30-year mortgage, there is about a 25% chance that that home will be flooded during the life of the mortgage. So by talking about risk in kind of real-life ways instead of in slightly more abstract terms, I think we might be successful in getting people to better appreciate the risk that they face.
Yeah, those are not good odds. What else?
Another thing that we could do is improve our enforcement mechanisms for carrying insurance. It is right now the law that you have to have flood insurance if you have a mortgage and your property is in a flood risk zone. But a lot of properties don't carry that insurance. They always do, of course, when they sign the mortgage. But very often, if you let the insurance lapse, the mortgagor will never know. Or if the mortgage is sold, then the second, you know, the bank that buys the mortgage may not know that that property is supposed to have flood insurance and so forth.
So the requirements are ready to buy insurance. But isn't that the problem, that it's that sense of false security? I hear you saying that if more people buy it, then you have more money in the pot. but also more of a delusion about your safety.
No, that's true. Nothing is going to replace smart development. And smarter development isn't going to be possible until we eliminate subsidies, because people, homeowners, business owners, property owners, aren't facing the full risk of their choices, right? This is a classic moral hazard where people are shielded from the consequences of their actions, and taxpayers pick up the burden. How to do that in real terms is a really hard political question right now. And I think what's likely is that we're just going to kick the can down the road for another 5 years.
That's Logan Strother, a visiting scholar in law and public affairs at Princeton. Logan, we'll post your writing at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
And we'd love to hear your national flood insurance stories. By the way, we can add, some environmentalists say flood insurance keeps people where they shouldn't live. So please weigh in with this story at hereandnow.org.
I wish I had lived. I could skate away on.
A cover of Joni Mitchell's River by the avant rock trio called Arc Iris, based in Providence, Rhode Island. The group is touring this fall, featuring their take on Mitchell's seminal 1971 album Blue. As Amelia Mason from WBUR reports, the band's sound draws from the source material and from Mitchell herself.
Hello, that's great.
In a basement in Providence, the three members of Arc Iris are getting ready to rehearse. The room is stuffed with equipment.
Check.
Synthesizers, drums, loop machines, effects pedals, and yards of cables linking it all together. For the past few months, Arc Iris has been performing, from start to finish, Joni Mitchell's seminal album Blue. You know the one.
All I really
is Mitchell's most iconic album. It's recognized as a masterpiece. In July, it earned the number one spot on NPR's list of the 150 greatest albums made by women. Blue epitomizes what some call confessional songwriting. Others call it poetry.
You can see what she's singing about a lot of the time.
That's Arc Iris frontwoman Jossie Adams.
Those images are images that you've seen. You know, like if we're talking about Case of You, just before our love got lost.
You said, I am as constant as a northern star. And I said, constantly in the darkness. Where's that at? If you want me, I'll be in the bar.
A lot of times she has that kind of contrast of a big idea and then bringing it back to something that you can really see.
In the blue TV screen light, I drew a map of Canada. Oh, Canada.
Of course, appreciating Joni Mitchell is not the same as covering an entire one of her albums. The project originally came about as part of a collaboration between Arc Iris and Ryan Miller, the lead singer for the band Guster. Miller wanted to do something big and ambitious. So the members of Arc Iris, all Joni Mitchell fans, proposed a reimagining of her most beloved album. Here's keyboardist Zach Tenorio Miller.
When we told him we wanted to do Blue, he said, Joni is in Jossie's DNA, and there's not much I can really add to that. And so we said, okay, we'll do it anyway.
It was important to the band that they put their own stamp on Mitchell's songs. They jettisoned her chord progressions and arrangements, keeping only the melodies, and rebuilt the songs from scratch. So, for something like The Last Time I Saw Richard...
The last time I saw Richard was Detroit in 68, and he told me...
The band started with a keyboard riff, and Adams began playing with the melody. The final version shifts time signatures and includes a wholly original prelude written around samples of Joni Mitchell's voice.
But I don't go around feeling misunderstood.
Mundanely misunderstood.
I see a butterfly. I see a butterfly. I go,
Joni, chase that
Of course, not everyone was pleased with the band's take on the classic album.
Zach started posting on hardcore fanbase Joni Mitchell Facebook pages.
I was like a mole and I just snuck in. I snuck into the Facebook group and I'm like, guys, check out this Arc Iris doing Last Time I Saw Richard video. And then just it was left and right. It was like, no, no, you can't do that.
It's probably no surprise that Joni Mitchell diehards didn't like Arc Iris's loose take on Blue. But the band says all that weird stuff was already there. It was in Mitchell's unusual phrasing and her sophisticated sense of harmony. And, of course, her melodies.
There's something about those melodies that are just unlike anything else I'd ever heard. Very familiar sounding, but also like from another planet.
We don't need no piece of paper from the city hall, keeping us tied into ruin.
I think her songwriting and her lyric writing and everything too, you can see that she loves to explore. She loves to see what's new and in herself, in the world, in music, in art.
But if you don't change, they'll get tired of you. You have to change.
The band begins every show the same way, with a sample of Joni Mitchell's voice cut from an interview.
They'll get tired of you. You have to change.
So when Arc Iris reimagines Blue, they aren't just making the case for their own peculiar vision of it. They're offering a new vision of Joni Mitchell, no longer the archetype of the confessional songwriter, but an explorer, an experimenter. Not just the subject, but the author of change.
You'll die inside. But if you don't change. Don't get tired of you. You have to change.
For Here and Now, I'm Amelia Mason. Just before
I left, I lost. And Joni, if you're listening, of course, we'd also love the real thing. Call.
Are we going to hand out the number? Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
She already has a number. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.